Marinette High School. Would you please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program, a national award-winning program, cleverly entitled Caught with Class. We invite students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, they're sent material about the case that they're going to join us for. They may engage in activities relating to this case. And then at noon, they are invited to come and speak with a justice who's been assigned to the day. Did you get to come at noon and speak? Can you stay right after the session? All right. We'll try and get somebody out here to talk with you. The discussion with the justice is always on the substance, not the substance, sorry.
Sorry.
We are going to talk about the substance. But the students, we talk about the procedures for taking a case, hearing a case, and deciding a case, not on the substance. And we'll do that right after this session for these students. And counsel are quite welcome, as well as everyone else, quite welcome to come and participate in that discussion. I do want to pay special recognition to special guests here today, and that's Judge Eugene Whitefish and Mrs. Whitefish, who have joined us. It's good seeing you both here. Judge Whitefish is with the Potawatomi Tribal Court, right?
Yes.
Do you want to say anything, Judge Whitefish?
Okay.
Good. Well, maybe we can look forward to seeing you afterwards, too, if you have a few moments to stay. But if you have to leave, we sure understand that. Good. With those introductions made, let me introduce the court. On my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Patrick Crooks. And on his left, Justice Pat Rogensack. And on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. I'll now call our third case for today, 10 AP 2533 John N. Croner versus Oneida Seven Generations Corporation. Arguing on behalf of John Croner is Michael Brown. Mr. Brown, you may take the podium.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Brown. I'm with the law firm Peterson, Burke & Cross, and I represent the plaintiff petitioner, John Croner.
Counsel, I think if you raise the podium and get closer to the microphone, it would be better. And you're going to get technological help from our high-tech person in doing this. Watch that carefully. Thank you, Deputy Marshal Pond.
The defendant in this matter is Oneida Seven Generations Corporation, which is a corporation chartered under the laws of the Oneida Tribe of Indians of Wisconsin. And although the standard operating procedures of the corporation state that the corporation was established under the laws of the state of Wisconsin to enable it to conduct normal business with Wisconsin-based businesses. And I'm paraphrasing, but that's language from the standard operating procedures.
Counselor, is it incorporated as a Wisconsin corporation or not?
No.
No. Okay. That was, thank you.
This appeal concerns the granting of Seven Generations' motion to transfer this case from the Brown County Circuit Court to the Oneida Tribal Forum specifically the Oneida Tribal Judicial System, which I may refer to as a tribal court or Oneida Court. And that motion was made pursuant to Wisconsin Statute 801, subsection 54. For a brief overview of the facts and procedure, which is largely for my own benefit, Mr. Croner had worked for Seven Generations for approximately 7 years. Seven Generations terminated his employment as of May of 2008. In September 2008, Mr. Croner filed his complaint in the Brown County Court. As of that, that complaint asserted two claims, both of which are Wisconsin contract law claims. One claim was for wrongful discharge contrary to public policy. The other claim was a contract law claim that I at least view as unique as an employee rights attorney. It involves a for-cause-based entitlement to employment based on handbook language of an employer or bylaws of an employer. And this court in the Ferraro case had made a determination with regard to that claim. And also in the Court of Appeals, I believe it was Bass and Clay were two cases there that dealt with the same type of claim. But one thing of note from Mr. Croner's perspective is that those two claims are particular to Wisconsin law and Wisconsin precedent. As far as I'm aware, from my knowledge in this record of the Oneida law, there is not an equivalent wrongful discharge claim or an equivalent contract claim based on a handbook or bylaws converting kind of default at-will employment into for-cause employment. So one big issue for Mr. Croner is that these claims don't, in our view, exist in the Oneida Tribal Forum. Now, after the complaint was filed, I believe it was in December of 2008, the defendant, Seven Generations, filed a motion to dismiss. And the bases for that motion were sovereign immunity as well as substantive contesting of the two contract-based claims. That motion was ultimately denied. That's not subject to appeal. However, during the pendency of that motion, which did take a while to reach decision, there were a few hearings that related to it, that motion. During the pendency of that motion, there was a letter from the tribal court sent to Judge Zeidmulder from the Brown County Court, and it was a brief one-page letter that stated that the tribal court is willing to assume jurisdiction of this case if the case were to be transferred under the Wisconsin transfer statute. Now, at that point, and in part because of that letter, Mr. Croner had made argument, and myself, to the circuit court judge that we felt there was an inconsistency in Seven Generations at that point still wanting to maintain a sovereign immunity defense, which is, of course, means there's exclusive jurisdiction to the tribal forum. But at the same time, the tribal court saying we view this to be a matter of discretionary transfer because that's the case and the statute is invoked. The statute 801 sub 5-4 by its own terms requires concurrent jurisdiction. So us looking or de facto to me what the tribal court's position was is in essence saying there's concurrent jurisdiction, which means there's jurisdiction in the Brown County Court, which means there can't be exclusive or sovereign immunity based argument for jurisdiction from Seven Generations' perspective. There was some argument to that effect in the motion to dismiss hearings, but ultimately, per the motion to dismiss, per the transfer motion reply brief, Seven Generations at that point formally withdrew sovereign immunity defense. So there's no issue of sovereign immunity alleged in this case. And as I had mentioned before, the motion to dismiss that was in part based on sovereign immunity and in part based on the substantive claims was in fact denied. And although after, at some point later in proceedings, Seven Generations had filed this motion to transfer pursuant to 801 sub 5-4, and that motion was granted. And it was also upheld following a motion for reconsideration and upheld by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals.
Could I ask a question?
Yeah.
Please. Who is attorney Bruce Olson?
I'm sorry?
Who is attorney Bruce Olson?
Bruce Olson was Seven Generations' attorney at the beginning of this case, and I believe he appeared at the first hearing with regard to the motion to dismiss. But I believe as of the second hearing, or sometime between those two hearings, Mr. Schober had taken over representation.
What kind of a communication was there from Mr. Olson to the Oneida Tribal Judicial System?
That I only kind of know from the outside, because I know Judge Zeidmulder had asked, I believe had asked Attorney Olson to contact the Oneida Tribal Court, and that letter that the tribal court had sent was in response to that inquiry. And I believe he had also sent a letter that was part of the record, although I don't have that memory at hand, but I believe Mr. Olson had sent a letter with a copy to the tribal court with a copy to Judge Zeidmulder in Brown County.
In your view, does the tribal court have concurrent jurisdiction?
No.
Why?
Because to have concurrent jurisdiction, under Statute 801.54 does not define concurrent jurisdiction, but under any definition of concurrent jurisdiction that could exist, as clarified by this court in particular, I would assume it's either going to involve personal jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction or both. And under any of those parameters, the Oneida Tribal Court does not have jurisdiction. As far as personal jurisdiction, the reason for that's relatively straightforward, and I don't think it's disputed. There's been no complaint filed by Mr. Croner or by the defendant for our Seven Generations for declaratory judgment in the tribal court. So there's no complaint, no
summons.
That's
not the issue, is it? Because once you come into state court, then you are subject to all the rules, right?
Yes.
And one of the rules of the court is that it can be transferred, right?
Yes.
So if it can be transferred, assuming there is concurrent jurisdiction, we'll get to that other part in a moment, you can't say I'm not transferred because I haven't been served by the tribal court. You've come into the court with all the rules of this court, of the trial court. And you've agreed. It's like someone giving you, having a counterclaim against you. You can put it in your answer. You don't have to serve you again with a subpoena or a summons.
The measure, when I myself looked, which certainly could be an imperfect review of personal jurisdiction, but as I looked at the law, often it's, I think primarily because it's kind of a checklist sort of issue where they talk about a complaint or a summons. Those seem to be variables that stand out in my mind. However, in this case, there was no acknowledgement from the tribal court, whether a notice of a scheduling conference or any sort of indication.
You may have procedural errors, but if you remove a case to the federal court, you don't have to have service of summons and complaint again. They have automatic personal jurisdiction over everybody because you were in trial court and there was personal jurisdiction. The plaintiff gave personal jurisdiction by filing the complaint. The defendant got personal jurisdiction by a summons and the complaint or agreed to jurisdiction. Just move it over. It's not a personal problem. Why am I wrong? What a question to put to counsel.
I believe that if there's not an acknowledgement of service or of jurisdiction over the person, whether it's through a notice or through some indication that court has in fact initiated proceedings as to the person, which I would see summons and a complaint to serve that function, maybe not in whole, but some acknowledgement of jurisdiction over the person.
Okay. Counselor, I would like you to go back to Justice Prosser's question, which is whether there is concurrent jurisdiction. And I would read to you from Plains Commerce Bank, which is a United States Supreme Court case that you quoted, I believe, in your brief. And it says, we begin by noting that whether the tribal court has adjudicative authority over non-members is a federal question. So with that focus in mind, that it's not state law that decides whether there is concurrent jurisdiction, but federal law, can you speak to that issue a little bit?
Yes. From my review of federal law, including the case law you mentioned, federal law describes tribal jurisdiction mainly in terms of subject matter jurisdiction. And the pertinent standards I've seen there, particularly in the Montana and Plains case, in my view, hold that a tribal court cannot exercise subject matter or does not have subject matter jurisdiction over a non-tribal member, such as Mr. Croner in this case, who is not a member of the Oneida tribe. They cannot have subject matter jurisdiction over a non-tribal member unless there's some sort of contractual or related relationship, which in fact was the case here, I believe. However, if there's such a relationship, the tribal legislature has to have exercised regulatory authority over those activities between those parties, and that here is what did not occur. There was not any regulation or ordinance or legislation that, as far as the record I'm aware of in my personal awareness, that had regulated the activities of Mr. Croner while employed with Seven Generations.
Mr. Brown, it's my understanding that the Court of Appeals looked at the issue of whether there was concurrent jurisdiction, looked at the Montana case and the two exceptions set forth in Montana, and came to the conclusion that there was indeed concurrent jurisdiction. And based on the relationship between Mr. Croner and the Oneidas. How do you answer that? I heard your partial answer, but you've got to address more directly, it seems to me, the Court of Appeals determination and their discussion of Montana and the exceptions.
Yes. In my understanding of the Court of Appeals decision, the Court of Appeals did not reach an affirmative decision as to subject matter jurisdiction existing. The Court of Appeals regarded that issue as an issue of Mr. Croner and myself not having flagged that issue of subject matter jurisdiction sufficiently in the motion for transfer briefing before the circuit court. I could respond to that particular position, but that was my understanding. The Court of Appeals did walk through the Montana standard and did talk about that analysis, but my understanding of the decision is that there is not a crystal clear decision from the Court of Appeals saying there is, in fact, subject matter jurisdiction. I do believe the Court of Appeals said that the tribal court believed that to be the case, and Seven Generations believed that to be the case. But as we're here today, I have yet to see a concrete authority or argument from Seven Generations saying we have subject matter jurisdiction under Montana, and here's why. Mr. Croner was regulated by the legislature, and therefore the tribal court can adjudicate the claims what has been regulated. But there's no sort of analysis like that has taken place, in my understanding.
What is the status of the case before the tribal court at this point? Is there a stay while the case came here, or what is the situation?
I have no indication of anything happening with the tribal court at this time.
I certainly read the Court of Appeals decision as, if not clearly stated, by implication stating that there was concurrent jurisdiction because they affirmed the action by the trial court in transferring under 80154. And one of the first things that has to be looked at is concurrent jurisdiction. So how else would you read that?
My reading is that the Court of Appeals walked through the relevant standards but did not affirmatively find that. But again, that's my own view.
They did affirm the trial court's action in transfer.
Correct, yes. In line with that, however, one argument that we had presented, Mr. Croner had presented to the Court of Appeals, and I will also present now, is that there's no affirmative evidence or legal authority by Seven Generations in the circuit court record saying, here's why there's subject matter jurisdiction. Here's the federal standard under Montana. Here are the pertinent facts as to there being a contractual or contract-like employment relationship between the parties. And because there was just no information on record, that in itself was a problem in my view, because under the Plains, the United States Supreme Court states that it is the burden of the tribal affiliated party to establish subject matter jurisdiction, to establish that it exists. And the Court of Appeals, how I read that decision, or at least part of it, was to be saying, yes, in effect, the Seven Generations could have done more to show that subject matter exists, but then again, Mr. Croner didn't disprove it. And where I disagree with that particular position is that just in the plain standard, that it is Seven Generations' burden, was and is, to show subject matter jurisdiction and to have done it before the circuit court.
What do they have to show? What was your complaint? You started the lawsuit, right?
Yes.
What was your complaint?
At the point of the lawsuit or at the point of with regard to subject matter?
Here. In the state court, what did you allege? What's your grievance?
Two claims, contract law claims under Wisconsin law.
So you are alleging that your client had a contract with the defendant, right?
Contract law rights, but not a written executed contract.
Well, you can have oral contracts, can't you?
Yes.
So you're the claim is based on contract law, right? Whether
yes.
It's at will principles or other principles, it's based on contract.
Yes.
With the defendant.
Yes.
And for work performed on tribal land?
Yes.
All right. And the defendant has a relationship to the tribe?
Yes.
All right. Why doesn't that fit under Montana? What else needs to be proved to come under the Montana exception that a tribe may regulate through tax, licensing, or other means the activities of non-members who enter consensual relationships? You had a consensual relationship, right?
Yes.
Well, that's what you're arguing. With the tribe or its members, through and it's a commercial dealing, right?
Yes.
All right. It's a contract.
Yes.
That's what they said. Through commercial dealing, contract, leases, or other arrangements. Why don't you fit under Montana as subject matter jurisdiction?
Because the relationship you correctly described and that law you read correctly characterizes was not regulated by the legislature.
That's, you know, I read Montana, and I didn't read it to say that the tribe has to have regulation or legislation on these matters. Where is your what do you rely on for the fact that they have to have regulations?
The Montana standard, which you read, but in conjunction with Plains,
right.
Mm-hmm. And the quote from Plains that I think is most on point for me is a tribe's adjudicative jurisdiction does not exceed its legislative jurisdiction.
Okay, but that means to me that it has legislative jurisdiction to regulate contracts, right? Could the tribe pass a contract code and adopt the restatement of contracts?
Yes. However, this particular contractual relationship concerned employment.
So the restatement of contracts concerns employment, too. It covers employment contracts.
The best answer I can give, Your Honor, is from the Shane decision itself, where the tribal court remarked, which I read to have frustration, it's quoted in the reply brief, that the tribal court was remarking that the tribal legislature should create legislation to cover these employment relationships.
Yeah, well, so should our legislature enact more laws that cover things, but They have the authority to do it, don't they, the tribe?
Correct.
All right. So you're saying that this language, whether a tribal court has adjudicative authority over non-members, is a federal question, and that it has to regulate it in order to have adjudicative powers.
Has to actually regulate, yes.
Do you have anything else that supports your interpretation?
Not as I can't think that quick.
This is a tough area. Yeah. This is a very tough area.
And I noticed my warning light's on too.
Yes.
May I ask this question? Suppose Mr. Croner says, I am the victim of a breach of contract and I want to file suit in tribal court. Could he have done that?
No. And the reason I say that is because these same claims do not, he doesn't have a written contract, a for-cause contract signed by both parties. And he also does not have an equivalent case law-derived claim like Wisconsin has with wrongful discharge contrary to public policy and the Ferraro and Clay and Bass line of cases.
Suppose the court doesn't agree with you that there isn't concurrent jurisdiction. If you lose on that point, are you all done or not?
No.
Okay.
The statute itself, the transfer statute, requires, the plain language requires consideration of a list of equitable factors, all of which, per the plain language of the statute, must be considered. The record here did not contain information as to all of those factors. Therefore, the circuit court judge was unable to carry out that statutory required duty of considering all the factors. And so that's another independent basis for which the motion should have been denied. Another basis for which the motion should have been denied is of those factors that were information was presented about, we disagree with the exercise of discretion in that regard of Wayne, that the equities did not favor Seven Generations. We feel, and we have asserted, that the equities favored Mr. Croner because those factors, particularly concerning issues of procedure and efficiency, did not favor transfer to a new forum after well over a year of litigation in the circuit court. Also, there is the issue of Sovereign Generations had gotten that letter in April 2009 from the tribal, or had gotten a copy of the letter from the tribal court indicating that the tribal court regarded transfer under the statute as a possibility, yet 14 months passed from that point until the point of them filing the motion at issue. And in those regards, the matter was delayed, not entirely due to Seven Generations' fault. I think there's just some issue of delay for reasons we don't know. But in regard to that 14-month delay, the equities certainly do not favor transfer to the tribal court forum to start a matter where there's no stated procedural rules or information about how the tribal court would handle this particular case, whether there be a new discovery or extended discovery calendar, whether Seven Generations would get another chance to file dispositive motions, which the deadline for which had passed in the Brown County Circuit Court at the point this matter was decided. And so there are a number of equitable factors that weigh in favor of Mr. Croner.
Mr. Brown, can I interrupt you for a minute? I want to be sure I understand your argument. Are you saying that the circuit court judge would be required to go one by one by one through all of the factors in 80154?
No. However, all information as to all factors must be on the record such that my red light.
You may continue, please.
Information must be on record as to all those factors such that the court can at least exercise that discretion whether or not the court actually states each factor by factor or states some sort of magic words, so to speak.
Hey, it was my understanding that Judge Zeidmulder said on the record that he had spent considerable time that day, I thought, going over all the materials. I would assume that that included 801.54, since he was going to make a decision on the basis of whether or not to follow that statute or rule. Is there anything to the contrary that indicates he never looked at the rule or statute?
I have no reason to doubt he looked at his file, entire case file, or whatever he said. I have no reason to doubt that. However, within that record, there is no information as to those factors involving procedure and efficiency of the tribal court. I mean, to this day, I don't know what the court schedule would be in the tribal court for this matter, whether there'd be another chance for dispositive motions and these other factors I mentioned. I don't know what rules of evidence may apply. I don't know basic procedural issues.
Well, didn't the Court of Appeals indicate that in going through the record and looking at what the circuit court judge said in granting the transfer, that he had touched upon a number of the factors that are set forth in the statute?
He certainly said he did a thorough review of the information. But again, I can only speak as to my own knowledge of the record, and I just thought some of the information was missing.
This rule didn't take effect until after you filed your lawsuit. Is that right?
Yes.
Make any difference?
Yes. I'm at a red light, so
if may I can continue. Okay.
Softball.
Thank you. Yes. The statute was, because of the facts you mentioned, the statute was retroactively applied. The lawsuit was filed in September of 2008. The motion and the effective date of this rule, 801 sub 5-4, was January 1 of 2009. And the motion was filed after the effective date of that rule, yet it sought to address conduct, the filing and existence of this lawsuit in Brown County that had occurred before the effective date. Because of those facts, it sought Seven Generations sought retroactive application. Now, if a statute is substantive in nature, as this court has found in Trinity, fairly recently in Trinity, if a statute is substantive in nature, it cannot be retroactively applied. And we've argued in the briefing that the statute was substantive in nature, at least as it applies to Mr. Croner, because all his claims, his whole ball of wax, so to speak, with the Wisconsin contract and wrongful discharge, those claims, those substantive claims, do not exist in the tribal forum. So we have argued that it is a substantive statute as applied to him as a party in this case.
How do you know that those claims can't be litigated in the tribal forum?
The quick answer I could give is the lack of subject matter jurisdiction based on the Montana standards as to regulation and the tribal court being unable to adjudicate a matter that it cannot regulate, so there's no subject matter jurisdiction. However, even if there's subject matter jurisdiction, there's no indication that these same claims or equivalent claims, which are kind of contract knockoff claims under Wisconsin precedent, even exist in the tribal forum. So we would argue that does affect Mr. Croner's substantive rights, because there's no case law that I'm aware of in the Oneida forum where I can see, oh, there's a wrongful discharge and contrary to public policy under that forum's law.
Why do you assume that the tribal court won't apply Wisconsin law? We sometimes don't have a lot of law in a particular area. We look for persuasive authority elsewhere.
I assume that simply because I haven't been told that would be the case.
Isn't that the problem that you, in fact, I was looking at page 39 of your brief where you kind of discussed this, and it's in essence that you indicate without knowing more about tribal law, it's hard to determine whether vested rights are disturbed or not. I mean, that's the impression that I get from reading this. It's almost like because of a lack of knowledge about what a tribal court can do, you assume that they can't do it.
What I know is that in Wisconsin court, I can look to precedent and see the elements as to the claims alleged and have confidence that we can, you know, assert those claims. And in the tribal forum, I don't, based on a lack of case law, to my awareness, that has claims and elements of this type. However, in saying that, I'm not saying that the tribal court could not create a new claim as a result of any litigation, just as this court originally had to do with Ferraro or whenever that first case was. But I don't know. I mean, that's the answer I keep coming up with myself in this case, is I don't know.
Well, wouldn't a Wisconsin court apply tribal law?
For what?
To determine whether there was what the contract terms were, what the employment terms were, whether this was at will, whether there was a breach. This contract was made with the tribe or the corporation. One party to the contract is tribal, right? The other is not.
Correct.
Why do you assume that Wisconsin law applies to determine this contract?
Based on the existence of the substantive claims and also the four corners of the documents that we've referenced as the handbook and bylaws, which could be analyzed under Wisconsin law similar to...
The handbook and bylaws that were drafted by...
Either the tribe or tribe-affiliated corporation.
Okay, so you're interpreting tribal matters, right? Tribal documents.
Correct. However, our theory of law would not differ. It's based on the language within the four corners of those documents, whoever drafted it, whether it indicates for-cause employment or does not.
So your documents that you use, you're drawing the facts from your claim from those documents? Is that what you're using them for? And then...
Correct. The documents, in our view, are evidence of for-cause employment, and there's a lack of evidence as to at-will employment, which in the Wisconsin line of cases was my read of the issues, that a handbook or bylaws from an employer, flyers, or whatever the case might be, something other than a jointly executed contract could give rise to for-cause employment.
Okay. So there are factors that then you were applying Wisconsin law to.
Yes.
Okay. And I think the Chief Justice's question was, well, why don't you just apply tribal law to those same factors?
And the answer I have to that is tribal law has its own specific regulations as to employees of the tribe, and we have not, and Seven Generations has not, we're in agreement there that Mr. Croner is not subject to those procedural and substantive regulations as would apply to a tribal member employee.
Thank you. But you are dealing with tribal documents.
One document clearly authored by the tribe and another document authored by Seven Generations.
Okay. But Seven Generations is related to the tribe.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Marcel Schober, representing Oneida Seven Generations Corporation.
May it please the court. I am Thomas Schober. I'm from Davis and Kielthaw, and I represent Oneida Seven Generations Corporation in this action. With me at council table is both our lawyers. The president of Oneida Seven Generations is William Cornelius. He's on the far end, and James Bittorf is from the Oneida Law Office. They're all licensed in the state.
I'll have to speak up. I see.
Am I a little soft?
Yes.
Yeah. I apologize. Sometimes if you pull that up a little bit, it makes it a little better. There you go. Thank
you. Is that better?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Brown and I have some major differences of opinion as to the procedural status of this case. The Oneida Seven Generations was not the party that brought the idea of the transfer to the tribal court. Trial Judge Zeidmulder was the person who, on his own, clearly on March 31st of 2009, made a complete record on his feeling that he felt that the claims that the plaintiff was making in his complaint brought into play the need to interpret tribal documents. One in particular is called the Oneida Pleadings and Practices Manual. We call it the Blue Book. Anyway, it's a thick manual that governs the employment relations of tribal employees. And the thing that gets a little confusing, Your Honors, is that there are two tribally created corporations that the Oneidas have. One is the Oneida Radisson Hotel Corporation, which runs the Radisson Hotel at the airport. The other is Oneida Seven Generations Corporation, which is engaged in business dealings for the tribe. Both, there is Oneida case law that's cited in our brief. There's a case called Beverly Shane versus the Oneida Airport Hotel Corporation. It dealt with this very problem. Beverly Shane was a tribal member who was working as a human resources director for the hotel. She was fired as an at-will employee and contended in tribal court that because she was a tribal member, she was entitled to be covered by the provisions of the Blue Book because of her status. The Oneida Appeals Commission, in that decision, which is in the record and is cited in a number of cases, ruled that the two subsidiary corporations of the tribe are permitted to use at-will employment, even though at-will employment may be contrary to the legislative feelings of the tribe itself. So at-will employment is not used with, as I understand it, with regular employees of the tribe, but it can be used for employees of the hotel corporation and employees of Oneida Seven Generations. This is where we have a disagreement. Those issues were brought to the attention of Judge Zeidmuller up front. He realized right away that in handling our motion to dismiss on sovereign immunity grounds and also our motion to dismiss on the grounds that he was an at-will employee, that in order to handle the issues, he was going to have to get involved in interpreting tribal documents. And he said, clear as a bell in the written record, that he felt that a better place for that was right out at the Oneida Tribal Court, which dealt with these things all the time. There are the record that we have here is incomplete in the sense that it does not develop the legislative authority of the tribal courts, which exists. It doesn't have anything in there about the procedures of the tribal courts, and there are. And that's only because those issues were not presented or litigated. That we didn't have a hearing about where the question of jurisdiction of the tribal court came up so that we would be answering those kinds of questions. It could be done easily. We could provide that information to this court if you would like it. I have some of those things with me right now. But the truth is,
Mr. Schober, that the August 31st session,
yes,
where the transfer was made, didn't the circuit court have to make a threshold determination that there was concurrent jurisdiction?
Yes, in order for the statute to apply.
And wasn't that the place for this to be brought up? I mean, you were the movement, were you not?
At that point, I was, Your Honor, because there had been quite a long delay, and there was an administrative problem of some sort that we don't know anything about that caused this. It's not attributable to Judge Zeidmuller. But there was either some miscommunication among the parties and the two courts that caused the delay. We're not exactly sure. I felt that it was important that the matter be brought into the record in the proper forms, or, you know, in the proper procedure, so that since he was looking. The way it worked was he had directed Bruce Olson, my predecessor on this file, in March of 2009 to contact the tribal court and see if they'd be willing to take this case. They wrote back within a month and it said they would accept it, but they thought it should be handled under 80154, which had just gone into play. So there was, at the time we filed our motions to dismiss in 2008, there was no section 80154. So part of the problem of why is there a late motion is, trying to make the record cleaner so that people could follow it and see what was going on. But there was quite a time delay there. And I have always felt that the courts had concurrent jurisdiction, that our case is very similar to the Teague case on its facts in that the parties were similar in what they did.
A contract between the tribe and a manager, I think it was the gaming,
yes, exactly,
facility, and there was a claim of breach of contract.
That's right.
That was the
he had a written case. Agreement, as I understand it, and the fight was over covenants and, you know, not to compete or something like that. But it seemed to me that it would be hard to argue that on the facts in our case that there wouldn't be concurrent jurisdiction when concurrent jurisdiction had been found in the Teague case. And it seemed.
What about it was found in the sense that the assumption was made there and no one debated it, but you've got a U.S. Supreme Court case since Teague that may raise questions. So let's go through concurrent jurisdiction. Is there any problem on personal jurisdiction over Mr. Croner?
I don't believe so. If the file is transferred from the state court to the tribal court, the jurisdiction will just flow, as it does on remands and removal in federal court, as you mentioned earlier.
Okay, that's personal. What about subject matter jurisdiction? What about the concept that I assume that the only place you can go now is Montana, that first exception?
It seems to apply. That's our opinion as well.
I know, but do you need legislation?
No. I think there's a miscommunication about what the legislation is. The Oneida tribe, through its own legislative process, has authorized the tribal courts, has set up the jurisdictional types of cases that they will take, has set up the procedural rules that they will use. They are different, and I suspect that given that there are 10 or 11 different tribes in the state with court systems, that it's likely that every tribe has different sets of rules. So one size does not fit all. I can tell you this, that the tribal court system does not have what we would think of as a trial-based jurisdiction. It does not have jury trials. It does not really operate to handle automobile accidents and products liability cases and the sorts of things that are handled in circuit court. It was originally set up as an appeal body for people who had problems with the administrative agencies of the tribe. The tribe employs 3,000 people directly, and about half of them are non-tribal members, but the rules apply to all of them. And so the Blue Book procedures give them rights if they're unhappy with disciplinary procedures, if they're discharge or different sorts of things. They have an avenue within that system if you're an employee of the tribe. If you're an employee of the two subsidiary corporations, your employment is at will, and that's the Shane case. And it's clear as a bell that the tribal court ruled that the corporations have the right to use at-will employment, even though, as Mr. Brown mentioned, there is some language in there where they were unhappy with the concept, but they recognize that it's valid and for use in these companies.
Well, if I understood Mr. Brown's argument, that in order to have adjudicative power, the tribal court has to have legislation on the issue, the legal issue that is in the case.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure I understand his argument that way. I thought he meant that they had to have acted from a legislative format on the specific point, and I don't think that's the rule. They have acted legislatively to create the courts. They have acted to regulate employment for 3,000 of their own employees. So I don't understand what the argument is. It seems to me that the tribe has done a lot to regulate, in general, the area of employment.
Counselor, do you believe that the tribe has the ability to legislate contrary to the laws of the state of Wisconsin in regard to when an at-will employee can bring a claim for wrongful discharge and when that employee cannot?
I suspect that they could. I have not thought about that question, but I think that they have the legislative authority as a sovereign to legislate on that matter if they chose to do it. I'm not aware that they have.
Let's assume that they do, and let's assume they make a law that's 100% inconsistent with the laws in Wisconsin, where you have to have, if you're at-will employee, you have to have a public policy basis, generally, to bring a claim for wrongful discharge. And let's say the Oneida Tribe legislates that you don't need any kind of a public policy basis, but you have to violate a particular provision that they set out in their statute. And if that
particular provision is violated, why then you can bring such a claim. So if these two laws are in conflict, Wisconsin law and Oneida law, for a non-tribal member, which one is the Oneida Nation going to apply in tribal court? Do you know?
I'm assuming that they would apply Oneida law, assuming it was a similar employment relationship directly with a tribal entity and on Oneida land. If something happened in the relationship that was off, if it was a non-tribal member and it was something that happened off the property of the tribe, then I think we fall back into those Supreme Court cases that deal with the limited jurisdiction over non-tribal members.
Thank you.
Mr. Schober, let me ask you about concurrent jurisdiction. I want to go back to that for a moment, if we might. Are you relying on the Montana case and the exceptions therein as far as concurrent jurisdiction?
Well, it wasn't brought up at the beginning of the case, Justice Crooks, but it seems to me that the Montana exceptions are what govern this case because Mr. Croner is a non-tribal member. So we have to fall within those exceptions in order to have jurisdiction over him in the tribal court.
Did I overread the Court of Appeals decision? Because I read the Court of Appeals decision as determining, since it's the first thing that has to be done, determining that there was concurrent jurisdiction because they affirmed the trial court's action in transfer. Is that a fair reading in your opinion?
I read it the same way. I thought there was no particular objection to the tribal court jurisdiction in the sense that you see it in some of the federal cases. It's not inconceivable to me that if the case were transferred to the tribal court and an objection were made to the court's jurisdiction, that a similar track into the federal courts wouldn't be followed. It seems to me that that would be the way it would be handled, because neither the tribal court can't overrule the state courts.
Counselor, what facts did you present to the trial court, if any, to show there was concurrent jurisdiction, or did the court just assume there was?
I think the court just assumed that there was, and it was it was not really a focus of any of the proceedings that I recall.
Okay.
It is definitely a focus of some of the Supreme Court cases.
Thank you.
Yeah. If this were, I'm going to move it out of the tribe and put it in Indiana. If this was a contract in Indiana with the state of Indiana, with a Wisconsin resident, and the Wisconsin resident thought there was a breach of contract and could get personal jurisdiction over the Indiana corporation here, and it was a breach of contract, what law would we apply in Wisconsin to determine the terms of the contract, the breach, the damages, et cetera?
I believe that at that point you have to analyze the contacts. It goes through a contact analysis that the court's done on many occasions, and determine also under the long-arm statute whether the court here had sufficient...
Satisfied the long-arm statute.
Okay.
We got personal jurisdiction.
I can't say which state's laws would apply because I don't know all of the details.
That's right, but... It's quite possible that it would be Indiana law.
Yes.
I could take it out of contract and put it into a tort of an auto accident across the border in Illinois.
Yes.
And the Illinois law would apply ordinarily.
Yes.
So if this stayed in Wisconsin courts, couldn't a good argument be made that the Wisconsin court had to apply tribal law?
That argument could be made, although the judge in this case felt that it would be inappropriate for him to rule on it. He just didn't want to try to guess what the tribal court would do, knowing that the tribal court was there and willing to handle cases like this.
Sure. But that's a practical matter of where the jurisdiction can make that determination. Why do you have a foreign jurisdiction do it? It's like the federal court sending us a certified question. They can do it.
Yep. Yes, ma'am.
But they send it to us because we think we can do it better because we know Wisconsin law better, theoretically, right?
Yes.
So what the judge is doing here is saying, hey, I got a court that I can certify this to. I mean, that's not how it happened because you needed a motion from you. But I'm just merely suggesting that you might apply the same law regardless of what court you were in.
Yes. It could happen. And that the idea of referring the question as the Seventh Circuit does with this court is crossed my mind as well. But in thinking about it, it doesn't appear that there's any procedure that would allow him to do that.
That's right. Mm-hmm. No, you have to do a transfer. There's no such procedure for a federal district court to certify a question here. So they just have to make the best they can figuring out what we would do.
Yes.
Did Mr. Croner ask for a jury trial in circuit court?
I don't recall, Your Honor. He may have.
Suppose he did. I mean, just hypothetically.
Okay.
Suppose he did, and the circuit court transferred the case to tribal court. Wouldn't Mr. Croner have been deprived of the right to a jury trial?
Well, you're correct that the tribal courts do not have juries. So whether that would be a deprivation of the right of a jury trial, I guess, is a matter of perception and perspective.
Well, for example, the Ho-Chunk have developed juries. I've been there. It's beautiful. They have the whole deal. So I think they have been sensitive to this issue.
I can't say that the Oneidas themselves may not be considering that. I just don't have that knowledge. But I recall defending a case in Menominee Court, and my recollection is that they also had a jury system, if I remember right. It was some years ago.
Well, let's just take hypothetically that the circuit court deprived Mr. Croner of the right to a jury trial. To do that, would you say he did a textbook job of applying 801-54-2?
Well, to the extent that Judge Zeitmulder didn't follow the list of factors referenced by Mr. Brown, that I would agree with. He did not. But I don't think the question of jury ever really came up in this case. It could, but I don't think it has yet, to my knowledge. I would never think that Judge Zeitmulder, knowing him as I do, that he would ever deny anyone a jury trial if he had the possibility of giving it to them.
It seems to me, counsel, that there's a dispute involving a particular litigant here. But when you get to the Supreme Court, and the first time that we're interpreting 801-54, we're going to look at the record and make some sort of pronouncement whether this was done correctly in the circuit court. Was it?
I think in substance it was, but not as a matter of precise procedure. I think Judge Zeitmulder understood the problem and was trying to deal with it. It felt that the major problem that faced him was this interpretation of tribal documents, both the corporate charter for the corporation, as well as the references in the complaint to the Oneida Pleading Employment Practices Manual, which the plaintiff, we understood, was relying on as the basis of his claim. And all of those things would have required him to interpret those documents, and that's what he felt that he couldn't do as good a job of. So he didn't on the record go through the other things. What he did make a point in March of 09 of saying that this was his feeling. It was not, you know, it wasn't the parties that wanted to do this. He felt, if you look at the transcript, you'll see repeatedly him saying this, that he wanted the tribal court to understand that it was coming from the judge. And that's where it got started. He also made findings that he had a fairly developed record for a pleading case, in that he had a number of affidavits that laid out the factual relationships and a lot of the documents. And he ruled that, as a matter of fact, that Mr. Croner was an at-will employee under Wisconsin law. And it, as I understood it, reading that transcript over, but I was not there when it happened, but the transcript is fairly clear, he gave Mr. Croner the option of going to tribal court if he wanted to enforce his rights that he was claiming under tribal law. And I did not see any objection at that for quite some time. The objections have always been technical. They're relating to the, you know, you didn't apply the right parts of the statute. But early on, I would have expected him to say, no, Your Honor, we do not want to go to tribal court. Go ahead and enter the order, which is what he was willing to do on March 31st of 2009. He was going to dismiss this case because Mr. Croner was an at-will employee. And it's all there. It's as clear as a bell in the record that that's what he was planning to do. And so then the communication was made to the tribal court, came back requesting the 80154 motion. And, you know, in hindsight, you could do things better most of the time. And this could probably have been handled better. I'll freely admit that.
Prejudicial error, then? Or harmless error?
I think it's harmless error, if it's an error at all.
If there was error.
Yes.
If, hypothetically, on the question of jury trial, if transfer denied Mr. Croner the right to a jury trial, is that an abridgment of his rights or a substantive change in his rights?
It's certainly different than what he would have in state court. He would have the right to a jury trial in state court. This type of case, I can't honestly say whether he asked for a jury trial, but he may have. If he has to have it heard in tribal court, would that constitute a denial of his constitutional rights under state law for a jury trial? I guess you could view it that way. I mean, that's the effect of it.
Well, we can ask Mr. Brown whether there was a motion for a jury trial.
Are you familiar with that mural up there?
No. I'm not sure.
Well, is a trial in territorial Wisconsin where the territorial judge, James Doty, is trying Chief Oshkosh for murder. And the issue is whether Judge Doty should apply territorial law or tribal law. And the great moral of the story is that Judge Doty applied tribal law, and Chief Oshkosh was found not guilty. Why couldn't the circuit court apply tribal law?
I think it could. It can apply laws of other states all the time, federal laws, decisions, statutes. Yes. I mean, I don't think I could argue that it couldn't. But I think it was his feeling that he wasn't, I don't say competent in the sense of that he didn't know anything, but he felt, you know, inexperienced in that area and felt that it would be better handled over by the tribe.
Ordinarily, when you have to apply foreign law, not always, you bring in an expert on that law, put them on the stand. You don't do that all the time, but can. Do you think tribal law governs this contract, or you think Wisconsin law does?
Because it is at-will employment as understood in Wisconsin, it would be applying Wisconsin's rules of at-will employment. That is what the corporations operate under. The tribe itself, with its own employees, has a different set of rules. Mm-hmm. There was something that I meant to say, and I forgot already. Apologize.
Shulman, can I come back for a minute to the jury trial issue? It's been a long time since I've been on the trial bench. But my recollection is that if you want a jury trial in a civil case, not only do you have to request it, but you have to pay a jury fee. And usually there is a scheduling order that sets a deadline for when that fee will be paid. I take it from your answers before that you don't know whether the request was made, whether a fee was paid, whether there was a deadline in the scheduling order. But at least am I correct that that's still the procedure?
The procedure is still the same as it was when you were trying cases, Judge.
Right.
But I got a copy of the April 20th, 2010 record, and on page 11, there's a notation from the clerk. I don't see that a jury fee has been paid, and the court said, okay, well, if a jury fee hasn't been paid, then you're going to try it to the court. So that was Judge Seidmulder in April of 2010.
That reaffirms my memory in regard to the way it works.
Let me ask this question. If you assume that there is concurrent jurisdiction in the tribal court, and the judge decides to transfer a case to tribal court, can you think of any situation where that would be an abuse of discretion?
For the state trial judge to send it to?
I mean, if you were just representing the other side for a moment, can you think of any situation where that would be an abuse of discretion?
Not offhand, Justice Prosser, I can't. I'm sure that we could think of some bad facts.
Suppose there was long delay in the tribal court. They were 5 years behind. Wouldn't get to it for 5 years.
That would be bad.
That would be bad. Trial court delay was only 6 months. State circuit court. That would be bad. Suppose the tribal court was many, many, many miles away. I mean, you're dealing with in Green Bay, you're dealing in Brown County. But suppose the tribal court was in a different county.
That could
across the state. I mean, the tribes can have land and have their court system across the state. That might be an abuse of discretion.
Yes, could be. I think that would be for you justices to decide what the bounds of the discretion that's acceptable would be. Because some of these questions may be things that would have to be legislated on by the tribe. Each tribe would have to address some of these problems and deal with them. Because the statute addresses a problem that is going to be there. The problem of multiple courts and how do you deal with them. So the statute itself, even if the statute were to go away, the problem would still be there. And
you had Teague and you didn't have a statute.
Right.
Near you had both courts running up. No one ever challenged either court in Teague.
Well, no, I read that factual situation and just thought, this is awful. You know, that this goes on this way, and there's no way to resolve it short of everybody ending up in federal court, I suppose, to decide which judgment prevails. But it's a difficult thing.
Your red light is on, and unless there are further questions,
Thank you all for having me.
I'm going to thank you on behalf of the court, and then we'll hear from Attorney Brown in rebuttal. Attorney Brown, was there a jury request here and a payment of fees?
My understanding is no, and that predates my involvement in the case, but from the record, I agree with Mr. Schober that there was not a request. I would like to say, though, Your Honor, in regard to that issue, of course, this case would be applied to other litigants, and the option of a jury trial is certainly an issue, even if in Mr. Croner's case it was not elected. But the other thing I would say in regard to a jury trial is, or the nature of trial, we don't have information, again, going to Justice Prosser's question of what was before the circuit court at the point these issues were discussed. There is no information before the circuit court about what type of trial would occur in the United Court. Would it be a bench trial or a jury trial or have that option, or would it be a panel? Similarly, there's no information about schedule. You know, would there be extended period of discovery, new dispositive motion deadline, and other things I've mentioned that were pertinent and important things for Mr. Croner to know?
Do you practice in Brown County?
Rarely, and I don't know. This has gone a long way.
Where do you
practice? On occasion, yes.
Appleton?
Yes. Most of my work is in federal court or agencies.
When you go to a different county, is everything the same as it is in Outagamie County?
Certainly not.
Certainly not. And do you need all this information before you go to court?
About the major things, yes, Your Honor.
How do you find them out?
Local rules, statutes.
Have you checked the Oneida Tribal Court rules and practices?
At some point in time, Your Honor, I do think I tried to research some issues. Mm-hmm. But again, and without trying to deflect your question, it was the Seven Generations' burden, or from some source, for that record that contained that information. So Judge Zeidmolder had that information, whether it's from the movement or from the tribal court, to have that information available. Not being the movement, you know, there's just not an issue. I was actively researching from that perspective at the time, you know, to try to kind of disprove a negative and say, oh, I looked up the procedures and, you know, I felt that this wasn't, you know, that there's the nature of trial is this, or that the procedural rules are different in this way. Mm-hmm. Just as a non-movement, I didn't see it to be our duty.
You needed that information for consideration of these factors in the rule?
I'm sorry, can you repeat?
You needed this information so that you could argue on the discretionary factors that the trial judge was to consider?
I needed the information to, first and foremost, to know what would occur, to know how this case might be handled, and yes, to argue those factors. But the biggest concern, if I could boil on Mr. Croner's concern, is that he doesn't know. He doesn't know if claims exist for him in that forum, if there's a wrongful discharge claim, or if there's a similar claim as Ferraro. He doesn't know what the schedule might be. He doesn't know the nature of trial as to the case he may have. We certainly have guesses, but we see that as Seven Generations' affirmative duty as the movement to provide that sort of information to the circuit court at the point of its motion.
What is the most significant loss of some right or any substantive right that you think that you would lose by going to tribal court?
In terms of substantive right, I point to the two claims. I don't know. I could certainly theorize that those two claims could be interpreted to exist by the United Tribal Court, but right now I view those as a loss because I don't know that those same claims exist in the tribal court. Mr. Schober referred to the tribal court handling employment cases regularly, and I have no reason to dispute that. However, I would presume that most of those cases that are handled are pursuant to the tribal procedures, regulations that are typically applied to tribal employees and to employees of the tribe itself as compared to these two corporate entities. There's a lot of uncertainty. I don't believe the same claims exist, so that's the biggest loss that I could see. But it's also this notion of uncertainty where if Mr. Croner's in Wisconsin court, he can look at the claims, look at the elements. But if he's going to the tribal court, he doesn't know those claims exist, and he also doesn't know big things about procedure, which I would view to be different than an issue of comparing local rules or anticipating those sorts of differences. I mean, these are things about the nature of a schedule. And will, you know, at the point of the motion to transfer briefing, the Seven Generations had not conducted any discovery, and they had about a 2.5 month window to do any discovery in the state court proceeding. And if this matter, following transfer, we were to learn at that point that procedurally there'd be a 9 month or 6 month period of discovery, then that unknown factor becoming known would benefit Seven Generations, but it'd be to the disadvantage of Mr. Croner, who had conducted written and oral discovery through Brown County proceedings up to that point.
Do you know what kind of rules of evidence will be applied in Oneida Court?
No.
Has any written materials been provided to you or are part of this record that would let us determine what kind of rules of evidence might apply?
Not to my knowledge, and I don't want to misspeak, but not to my knowledge.
Okay.
I'll try to summarize. Oh, my red light is on.
You've got one long sentence to summarize.
Oh, boy. It'll be a run-on sentence. The four reasons why this motion should be denied and are independent reasons as that are there no concurrent jurisdiction. The circuit court did not consider all factors as required by the plain language of the transfer statute. The weighing of factors had favored Mr. Croner, although that discretional weighing never should have even factored in. This shouldn't have reached that point. And finally, the statute is retroactively applied, and it's a substantive statute in nature as applied to Mr. Croner as a party. And even if deemed procedural, it still impairs his rights and impairs his contractual allegations against the party. And I'll stop.
Thank you. On behalf of the court, I want to thank you, Mr. Brown, and thank you, Mr. Schober, for arguing the first case we have on transfer of civil cases from circuit court to tribal court. As you all know, this is a rule that the court adopted. It's in the statute books, but it's a court-adopted rule. So I want to thank you for your briefs and for your oral argument, and that completes the argument on 10-AP-2533. The court is in recess until its next oral argument, and the court will reconvene in closed conference at 3:20. If the students remain, Justice Ziegler, can you see the students?
Gladly.
Good. So now you have somebody who's already done this once today, so she's really prepared and can do it well. So Justice Ziegler will be in charge.